Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, as federal health care cuts begin to take effect, thousands of New Yorkers are facing changes that could affect their daily lives. Hudson Valley Assemblymember Sarah Hata Shrestha has been holding town halls to hear directly from residents, and we'll hear directly from her ahead of her next town hall tomorrow in Rosendale. We're going behind the scenes of natural history museums, from field research and specimen collection to the art and science of taxidermy. The Institute for Natural History Arts is bringing those disciplines together for its Field Days program this weekend in the Catskills. Plus, local economic perspective from James B. Huntington, and it's a pickle party. Sullivan Public's Pickle Party returns this weekend with local vendors, music, pickleball, and a pickle-eating contest. Coming up after the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. On Wall Street, stocks opened mixed this morning as a trade rift widens between the U.S. and Canada. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow rose around 160 points and the Nasdaq fell about 215 points in early trading.
Both the Chamber of Commerce and the Business Roundtable are urging the U.S. and Canada to get back to the bargaining table in hopes of de-escalating this latest trade dust-up. President Trump imposed 50% tariffs on billions of dollars worth of Canadian imports over the weekend after talks collapsed late Friday. Canada has threatened to retaliate with tariffs of its own in about 2 weeks, which could offer a window for renewed negotiation. Investors will get an update on inflation and consumer spending later this week. The Commerce Department's price gauge, which is closely watched by the Federal Reserve, is expected to show that annual inflation cooled slightly last month, though prices are still climbing faster than the central bank would like. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Iran says it will punish regional countries if they cooperate with President Trump's new economic sanctions that are set to be announced by Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent today. This is Iran's economy is already in free fall from existing U.S. sanctions. Trump says the U.S. will punish countries that help Iran avoid sanctions. NPR's Adil Al-Shalchi reports Iran's new security chief says on state TV that Iran would retaliate in, quote, a seismic manner to Trump's plans.
The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Ismail Baghaei called the expected sanctions a form of economic terrorism to punish Iran. Iranian Security Chief Mohsen Rezaei said that any country partnering in these new economic restrictions would be considered an enemy and that Iran will target their interests. Since the beginning of the war, Iran has targeted U.S. installations in Jordan and Gulf countries with drones and missiles. Rezaei said that Iran would attack oil tankers leaving through the Persian Gulf through alternative routes. He added that, quote, not even a single drop of oil will leave the region. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Istanbul.
NPR has gotten rare insight into how some members of the National Guard are feeling about President Trump's ongoing deployment to Washington, D.C., where thousands of armed, uniformed troops have been patrolling for more than a year. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf has more.
Three Guard members who each spent many months on the D.C. mission spoke to NPR candidly on the condition of anonymity, as they're not authorized to speak publicly. They had concerns about the cost, stretching into the billions, worries about the constant patrols normalizing the presence of armed military, and the damage they feel Trump's deployments are causing to the reputation of the National Guard.
I will say very frankly that the bad taste that this mission left in my mouth, it actually embarrasses me to be involved in any way.
Another said, quote, it feels like the Guard is being exploited. The White House responded by reiterating how safe D.C. is now without providing evidence the Guard has decreased crime. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News. British Prime Minister Andy Burnham is in Kyiv today, meeting Ukrainian President Zelensky and co-chairing a meeting with international leaders. His visit coincides with Ukraine's Independence Day and marks his first overseas trip since taking office. Other European leaders, including European Council President Antonio Costa, are also in Kyiv. Burnham's office says the UK government has agreed to allow defense company MBDA to release classified information about British components used in this scalp missile, which could move along plans for local production in Ukraine. Scientists say people who participate in high-intensity interval training, also known as HIIT, may reap certain benefits that aren't seen with other forms of aerobic exercise. That's according to research published this month by a team of researchers at Rockefeller University, NPR's Will Stone reports.
The study shows high-intensity training provokes a robust response throughout the bloodstream. Those in the study completed either six all-out sprints on the bike for 30 seconds with a few minutes rest, or a moderate-paced ride for 90 minutes. There were many more changes in proteins and other molecules in the high-intensity group. The researchers then compared some of those changes to a large database from the UK and found they were associated with better cardiovascular and metabolic health. However, they emphasized the results come from young, healthy adults and need to be confirmed in different populations. They say it does not prove high intensity is necessarily better. Will Stone, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. As the impacts of the Trump administration's federal health care cuts take shape for thousands of New Yorkers, how is it affecting people's daily lives? New York Assembly member Sarah Hanna-Shrestha has been hosting a series of town halls across the Hudson Valley this summer to find out. Her next town hall is scheduled for tomorrow, August 25th at 6 p.m. at the Rosendale Community Center. Radio Catskill's Patricio Robayo spoke with Assemblymember Shrestha, who represents the 103rd Assembly District, which includes Ulster and Dutchess counties, about the town halls.
You'll be hosting seven town halls across your district focusing on the rising healthcare costs. You already completed two of these town halls this past week. I just want to go over what is the purpose of these town halls and why did you feel it was important to hear from your constituents now?
Yes. So, you know, our healthcare system was already pretty broken and lots of people have been struggling even when they are insured because of copays, deductibles, not enough providers being in their network. People are struggling with taking care of their family, you know, their parents who might be sick and so on. So we already knew this and this is a nationwide phenomenon, right? But what happened that was, you know, unique for this time is that last year, the Trump administration passed their One Big Beautiful Bill, which made, you know, severe cuts to healthcare. So that has passed a lot of costs to local governments, so like state governments, and in the case of New York, also county governments. But one of the things that happened is we lost the federal funding that would have made New York's essential plan solvent, right? So we had this solvent plan that covered 70% of somebody's healthcare costs, and it covered two groups of people. One group was people who are income qualified for federal Medicaid, but they are not because of their immigration status. So this is about 10% of the people. The second group was people who are low income, but they're making just too much money for Medicaid. So that's, you know, going up to 250% of the federal poverty line. That was about 90% of the people. So we lost the funding that would make this plan solvent. And we also have a legal obligation in the state of New York coming from a court ruling that says as long as somebody is income qualified for federal Medicaid, New York has to cover them. Like the immigration status cannot matter. So it's not just a choice. It's also an obligation that New York has. So in this year's budget, you know, we were disappointed that the state responded by basically lowering the income eligibility from 250% of the federal poverty line to 200% of the federal poverty line instead of spending more money to cover everyone, which kicked off around 450,000 people off their healthcare plan on July 1st. So lots of these people went scrambling to the marketplace healthcare options, and now they are paying, you know, many people who came to my two town halls so far and have taken our healthcare survey are reporting paying around $800 a month just in premiums. And these are people making less than 250% of the federal poverty line, right? And some of these people are actually also taking a pay cut so that they can stay in the plan instead of having to be punished for making a little bit too much money to qualify. And the rest who have not done anything to solve the problem yet, which they have until August 30th, are probably going to get uninsured. And when people get uninsured, it is bad for everybody else. You know, the cost of covering people who remain in the plan goes up. Uninsured people tend to skip preventive care and end up in emergency rooms more. That costs hospitals money. That cost also gets passed on to the rest of us. So generally speaking, it is actually not beneficial to have people lose their insurance. And then finally, the third thing is the Trump administration also now requires these thing called work requirements to stay on Medicaid. So that's just more paperwork and requirement that people have to file very frequently. And the healthy people on Medicaid are not going to bother with this. So they're also going to be, unintentionally falling off of the plan. So that, again, leaves the more sicker people who are, staying, doing the paperwork to stay on the plan, having a higher price to cover them. So this is just sort of an exceptional thing that is happening right now. So we felt like because 450,000 New Yorkers just lost their health insurance and we have not really solved the healthcare problem, we felt like we really needed to go all over the district, hear people's stories, and also talk about the solution because we have known for a long time the solution is single-payer universal healthcare. It covers everyone, it takes profit out of the picture, and it saves a lot of money because it is a powerful single plan that, has a lot of leverage to negotiate drug prices, cut administrative costs, things like that. And I feel like if we are going to seriously pass something like this, because this conversation has been kicking around since the 1940s, and if we're going to seriously do something about this, I felt like we have to start talking to our constituents, let them know how it even works, because lots of people support it because it's a great idea, but a lot of people don't know how it works. So we felt like it was important to have that conversation.
And let's go a little bit more in depth with those two town halls you had. You mentioned the stories about the premiums going up. What other stories are you hearing from residents?
Yeah, yesterday we had a really powerful story from a young teacher. So usually, teachers have pretty good healthcare plans because they're in a powerful union. And the union historically, when the fight for national healthcare was lost in the mid 1900s, unions really started prioritizing negotiating good health benefits for their members. So generally speaking, being in a union means you have a decent healthcare plan. But we really heard a powerful story from a young teacher yesterday who has been diagnosed with cancer, and despite having this good insurance, had to go through a lot of hurdles to even get all of the services that eventually, she was denied for a service that eventually detected the cancer to begin with. But now she feels very strongly that she is not a free person because she cannot leave this job or lose this job if she needs to have access to this continued care, right? So here's a person who needs this continued and, a pretty specific form of care, regardless of whether she has a job or not, but she is in a precarious situation. She doesn't have the option to say, I'm going to take a break from my work and just focus on recovering. She does not have that option because she would lose her health insurance. She also knows that lots of teachers are getting laid off and losing their jobs. So there's another stress of being forced to leave this job, right? So I really, I'm very interested in addressing these concerns that are coming from people who have good healthcare plans from union because they are concerned how this is going to affect them. And the reality is it's going to be a step forward for everyone, even people who have a good healthcare plan. It's going to be a step forward. The reason is we remove copays, deductibles, premiums, but we also actually remove the requirement for providers to be in network. So if you're covered under this plan, any provider in the state, you can see them. And that is really expanding your choices, right? So I really thought that was a powerful story. Another was a young woman, because, usually we don't attract a lot of young people when we're talking about healthcare. But there was a young woman, who's just finished her school and is about to get her first job, about to start her first job. But she also has health issues that needs, specific care. And she's really concerned that when she starts this job, she might actually make a little bit too much money to lose the insurance that she has right now, and have to, be forced to switch to an insurance that's going to be slightly more restrictive and doesn't cover as many things as she needs. And this is the reality of people, right? Just because you're insured doesn't mean you actually have your needs met. So this is also why we're doing the healthcare survey. And, you know, over 50% of the people who took the survey and are insured are saying that their needs are not met.
Not only that, you mentioned about having the health insurance tied to a job. I think once you remove that barrier, it gives other folks options to explore other careers, other things. Because I'm sure, I know in my personal life, sometimes you stay with a job just because of the health insurance.
Yes. When we asked people, you know, what is a challenge you experience in your healthcare, the people who were getting their insurance through a full-time job, you know, the biggest answer in that group was that they have to stick with this job, which is a challenge in itself. And actually, you know, even more concerning is if you're a spouse and you're in an abusive relationship, your healthcare is tied to staying with this spouse, because that's how you're getting healthcare, right? So, you know, tying conditions to people's ability to get healthcare is a very, very oppressive system. It really limits what people have the freedom to do with their life, which is something that we think is fundamentally wrong.
Yeah. And we spoke about, you spoke about in the beginning about the One Big Beautiful Bill, the law that was signed by President Trump last July. Like you mentioned, that brought healthcare changes, including the subsidies into Medicare and drug coverage and new work requirements for those on SNAP and changes to eligibility for Medicaid coverage for adults. If you just want to go over a little bit again, what have been some of the immediate and long-term impacts that you're hearing from your residents and other residents, as well as hospitals and healthcare providers and government agencies?
Yes. So the first thing is these federal cuts are going to be phased in over 10 years. So they start out a little smaller, but then they keep getting worse over time. And conveniently, they've also been scheduled to mostly go into effect after the midterm elections. You know, so it's definitely a very politically motivated maneuver as well. But in terms of system-wide impacts, you know, there's the impact on state budget, obviously. A large amount of federal funding that the state gets is for healthcare. So that's going to be impacted. And, you know, the initial impact, I believe, is around $8 billion. But outside of the state budget, there's about over $12 billion impact on generally the healthcare system. We already have about 30% of hospitals in the state who are financially unstable. And these are especially rural hospitals and safety net hospitals, because what happens is when people go get care through Medicaid or Medicare, the providers are not reimbursed the full cost because there's a fixed reimbursement rate. So anytime a provider is treating these high need people, they're losing a little bit of money, which again is a very counterintuitive system, right? Providers shouldn't be punished for, you know, treating people who need the care the most. And then we also have the issue of the fact that a lot of these hospitals don't even have safe staffing. They are overworking their nurses and technicians, which is part of the reason why the nurses union and the technician unions are, you know, two of the most supportive proponents of this proposal. Because right now, with the federal money being lost, you know, system-wide in the healthcare sector, we're also looking at possibly 200,000 healthcare workers in the state of New York losing their job, which again would be really disastrous, you know. So all of this has an impact even for people who have insurance, because imagine if you have a great insurance, you live in Ulster County or whatever, but then your hospitals are closing, your services are shrinking. That's not good for anyone, right? And the other impact we're seeing is the costs that are shifted to county level. So counties can only primarily raise their revenues through property taxes. It's either property taxes, sales taxes, or occupancy taxes. But generally speaking, taxes that are a little bit regressive because it has a higher burden on people who may not have a lot of money, right? You might own a house, but you might not have money. And if the property tax keeps going up, that's going to impact you. A lot of our small businesses are struggling with either rent, high rent, or high property tax, even when they own the building, right? So the county is being forced, in our case, Ulster County, is being forced to plan preemptively on how to prevent a property tax hike. So they introduced this proposal called Fair Taxes that needs state authorization. So Senator Hinchey and I are carrying the bill for state authorization. And that would allow them to collect a minimal surcharge, you know, a very small, less than 1% surcharge from the 1% highest earners in the county. And if that generates around $9 million, which is the projection, then they wouldn't have to really raise property taxes. But of course, this being an election year, the Republicans and the right wing are trying to make this an issue by saying, oh, Democrats are always raising their taxes, you know, they will tax you to death and so on, completely not acknowledging the fact that the federal government has left the county with no options. The federal government is basically saying, you can raise property taxes if you want. This is not our problem, right? And the county is trying to make sure that we don't pass this cost to a big number of people, that we get it from a targeted number of people who can afford to pay a little bit more.
Now, your next town hall is scheduled for Tuesday, August 25th at 6 p.m. It's going to happen at the Rosendale Community Center. What can folks expect if they come?
We are doing a little bit of review of, you know, how things are changing because of the federal cuts. Then we are also looking at what other countries are doing with their healthcare system, because even if somebody can debate that no country has a perfect health system, I think what is not debatable is that many countries have a better system than we do, right? How are other countries achieving universal healthcare? Because Mexico is phasing universal healthcare starting January 1st, 2027, which means that pretty soon the United States is going to be the only country in the continent that does not have universal healthcare. We're also going to revisit, you know, how, when it was proposed the first time and how it was killed and so on, as, you know, it died in the committee when President Truman proposed it. Then we're going to dive into how the specific single-payer proposal in the state of New York, which is called the New York Health Act, works, because we really want people to understand how it works and not just why it's great, because we have to do a high level of organization to be able to pass something like that. Even when Medicare was first introduced, there was a lot of opposition. You know, it was only because seniors really mobilized in support that they were able to pass that. So that's sort of what we're going to go through in terms of the information that comes from me. And then after that, we're going to hear from the audience stories they want to share, any comments they have on what we presented, as well as any questions that they have.
If folks are unable to go to the town halls in person, are there other ways that they can participate?
Yes. So the survey is something that we are encouraging everyone to take, and it has a field for a question or a comment. And we're compiling all of those questions to be able to answer them. And the information that people put in the survey, such as their employment, their salary level, and so on, helps us give them very precise answers, because those things factor how people will be impacted, right? The one at SUNY New Paltz that we're doing, we're going to try to see if we can live stream that, because they have the technology set up for it. I should also mention that we are going to be joined by former assembly member Dick Gottfried, who originally introduced this bill. He's going to be joining us via Zoom for the Q&A section. And he's been the one, you know, really keeping this fight alive in New York State. But now he is relatively recently retired, but he's still helping us out. And then after all of our town halls are done on September 3rd, we're going to see if we can do a recorded version with like my voiceover on the slides that we can put up for the information part. But, you know, I think we will try to be out there as much as possible for us to take the information from people in terms of their stories.
Member, before we go, is there anything else that we have not touched on you want folks to know?
Yeah, sure. You know, I think that people, the main thing is, we don't want people to be discouraged by thinking that something is impossible. We are really seeing a change in our political landscape in terms of what people are fed up with, right? You know, for example, Hakeem Jeffries was on TV saying he doesn't support Medicare for all. And in my experience, that is a very unpopular opinion amongst Democratic voters. I think Democratic voters want people like Hakeem Jeffries to actually represent what they want and to actually solve the problems that people who are voting Democratic want solved. So I think I'm sensing a lot of enthusiasm from people to make our politicians do the right thing. There are also lots of new people running for office, you know, so I am a DSA elected. And in the state assembly, we are going from 5 to, I think, like around 11 people next year. So that's a significant change that's happening, because all of us really are fed up with the status quo. So I want people to not be discouraged and pessimist. None of this is easy. At the same time, we do need everybody to sort of get involved and help us organize and build a big movement that can take this on, because that is what is necessary. And we really have to have an army of volunteers who's ready to go anytime there's an opportunity that opens up. That's the only way that we can do this. So, you know, staying connected with our office, coming to our political education programs and so on is a great start.
Thank you so much for talking to us. I do really appreciate it. Again, your next town hall was going to happen on Tuesday, August 25th at 6 p.m. And it's happening at the Rosendale Community Center. Thank you so much for joining us. I do really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And that was Patricia Rubio with Assemblymember Sarah Hanna Shrestha, who represents the 103rd District in New York. We'll take a break. And when we come back, it's time for Local Economic Perspective from our own James B. Huntington. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from Garnet Health Medical Center, Catskills, with campuses in Harris and Calicoon, offering inpatient and outpatient services to Sullivan County and surrounding communities. Learn more at garnethealth.org.
The federal government is in the midst of rounding up 1,000 wild horses in Colorado, using a helicopter to herd them off the range. Advocates call these gathers cruel, while supporters believe it's necessary to help preserve the land.
We want to see the ground healthy. We want to see it productive. We want to see it used by all animals.
That story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen to All Things Considered this afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill on a Monday. That's when we check in with our local economist and author, James B. Huntington, for some local economic perspective. James B., welcome.
Good morning, Tim. Good morning, listeners.
Well, let's start off with something that maybe a lot of folks don't know about. It is something, though, that really is the core benchmark for global finance, the $32 trillion treasury market. How does the treasury market influence the economy for folks?
Well, first of all, a couple things to relate. In case you haven't heard, we reached $40 trillion in national debt within the past week, and it has a psychological effect, and it's having an increasing effect on how our government can spend. The major things we're getting is that interest rates on the Treasury bills and notes and bonds and such, they use different names for different lengths of time. What happens with this debt, with most of that $40 trillion, is it is made available to people to invest in by bonds that have their own interest rates. Those rates have gone up. They've reached a two-decade high. The 30-year Treasury is now at 5.3%. So there are other ones with different rates and different times. They issue a whole variety of things. These all have maturities, dates when it has to be paid back. So what we're getting, well, the real thing we have here is this is a starting point for mortgage rates, which means that as it goes up, as the amount of money our government has to pay to service this debt gets higher, mortgage rates get higher also. So already the average 30-year mortgage has gone up from 6% earlier in the year to 6.67% now, which is a significant amount of money. If you ever ran these things, ran different interest rates using a program, you'll find it makes a real difference. I mean, $100 or $200 a month or more, just the difference between these things here, depending on, of course, how much you're borrowing. So that's a real danger, and we have other dangers, other things that can happen, or other things that are related. We have other creditors and such out there besides the federal government.
Yeah, part of that is the AI borrowing binge, which has helped driving that national debt. It kind of touches everything, really. How does the AI borrowing binge help drive up those government bond yields?
Well, before, the AI debt was covered by money coming in to the companies, mostly. a lot of the companies that are using a lot of AI, the big IT firms, are just gobbling up cash from large numbers of users for buying or leasing or using their products in some form. But we're reaching a point where that's not going to work anymore, where they just don't have the money. They're borrowing more and more. So they are looking to borrow increasing amounts of money. A lot of them are floating their own bond issues. So along with the T-bills and such that I just mentioned, you can also buy bonds from any various IT companies. So the whole way out there is that there are more and more people, there's more money, there are more bonds that are competing for a relatively fixed set of investors. So the AI companies also are having to pay more and more. So all around you have demand, or shall we say the supply of debt is outstripping the demand for buying it, investing in it. And so rates are going up both ways. So in the way, the government bonds and the AI bonds are going to push each other up. It's getting higher and higher. Of course, the real problem, the real thing we have with the national debt being bad, being damaging, is that the debt service, the amount of money the government has to pay on it, it pushes other things they could be doing with money aside. And it continues to go up. It's a problem with both parties. There's neither one has really been paying attention to keeping the deficit low over the past couple of decades or so. And it's going to cause problems. I mean, as our government can't afford to pay things, can't afford to buy a lot of things because they're paying so much to service all this debt they have. So that could well be damaging. As it continues, as that grows, it's going to keep damaging prosperity and damaging the economy.
And, you know, as you said, it's all related. The interest rates, as we've been talking about, have hit their highest levels in nearly 20 years. The yield's rising. So, you know, after roughly two decades of ultra-low interest rates, there's going to be some rapid adjustment here in the economy. What are some of the risks posed by the end of these low borrowing costs?
Well, we have deficits looking more sustainable. They're less so now. The risks we have are that we're going to have less money. We may have government having increasing problems servicing these things and not being able to pay for as many programs and maintain things as before. And the higher this gets, the higher interest rates get, and the higher the national debt gets, the more and more that gets to be a problem. And that's the risk.
Let's talk about ways that things can be a little more affordable. How about auto loan refinancing? When could it actually save you money?
Well, we haven't heard a lot about this, but now that car payments are starting to look like house payments were a generation ago, and refinancing house payments as interest rates go down has been a common thing. So we're seeing that with car payments also. There are companies that will help you with this, that will look at your loan and see if there's a way that it can be refinanced, the same sort of thing. They have a sequence of things to do here they recommend. The first thing is look at the value of your car. Now, values of cars have gone up generally because as time goes on, they have been lasting longer and longer, so they're really worth more. They're an average of 13 years old on the road right now. That is ancient. Those of us, when I started realizing paying attention to cars and how long they lasted in the 60s, they were often good for only about 3 years, 50,000 miles. And the quality of them from the U.S. and other countries in general is getting higher and higher. So that means the value of your car will be more, and that will mean that you can quite possibly get a better deal on financing it. So you can put in for pre-approvals. You can see what your options would be, what people will offer you, and figure out whether it's worth it or not. So for some, it will be worth it. For some, there won't be available. And interest rates, car loans are really based much more on the Federal Reserve's interest rate, the discount rate they set, the federal funds rate. And that has not gone up recently. It's been sitting the same for several months. So you may have, it may be surprising if you have the kind of car that's gone up more in value recently, you may be able actually to pay less in your monthly payments for it.
All right. Well, let's take a look at what numbers are doing across the board when it comes to stock, oil, foreign exchange prices this morning. And how did they change since last week?
Okay, as of early this morning, and these are 1 week differences, gold was $46.41 the ounce. That's up $2.48 in the week. That led the pack. It was good, as better than anything else, except silver. It was much the same as silver. Silver followed closely. It's now $68.80, up $3.46. The ounce, it has the same ratio, much the same as it was a week ago, about 67.5 to 1. Hanging on with gold, there are reasons. Actually, this concern about the U.S. deficit has certainly helped the metals markets in particular. Dow Jones Industrial Average, 53,277. That's down 455. That's a down week, but it looked worse earlier in the week. We finished up with a strong day, so it wasn't as bad as it might have been. NASDAQ, 26,180 minus 549. That did worse. It really lost. It really neutralized its week last time, which was better than the Dow was. Oil, West Texas Intermediate, $85.17, the 42-gallon barrel. That is up $2.94, much the same as the last week. It's just ever-increasing, rising tensions in the Gulf. That is what's affecting the price of oil, and there have been a lot of words exchanged, not all being prudent and peaceful, and it's looking quite nervous, really. I'd say nervous more than just bad for oil prices right now. Bitcoin, however, 77,095, up 13,000 and almost 800. That came out of nowhere, but it may be reacting. Supposedly, it doesn't always react to shaky economic times, but sometimes it does. And this time, Bitcoin has been sort of asleep for several months, but up jumped this time. British pound, 1.3628. That's up 0.75 cents. That's now 6 straight reports I've given where it has gained. And the same thing is true with the euro, 1.1665, up 0.75 cents. Both of those are just continuing to gain. There's just more fear about the dollar, and the $40 trillion thing did not help. Japanese yen, 100 yen piece, is still at 63 cents. Much the same, it looks like it's going back to sleep after some activity and efforts to prop it up. Just not doing anything there. Okay, overall, we have needless problems and tensions that hurt stocks in the past week, but it helped metals and Bitcoin, but all of this could easily reverse itself this week, and we could have the real inverse of what happened down the line here this week, depending on what happens in the Gulf.
Well, we know you'll be keeping an eye on it for us, our local economist and author, James B. Huntington. James B., thanks so much. We'll talk to you next Monday.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, listeners.
Coming up, when you walk through a natural history museum, you're seeing the finished product. But what happens before a specimen becomes part of the exhibit? We're going to learn more about the work behind some of the world's most recognizable natural history displays next. This is Radio Chatskill.
Wherever you go, take Radio Catskill with you. Stream your favorite shows, music, and podcasts anytime, anywhere with our new and improved app. Stay connected with local news and national headlines all in one place. You can even send us your thoughts with the Talk to Us feature, audio or video, right from your phone. No radio? No problem. Just press play. It's Radio Catskill right in your pocket. Download the app today on iPhone or Android.
Hi, I'm co-star Grace KG, host of the Music Emporium. 2 hours of great music right here on Radio Catskill. Sometimes I start out with a little bit of talk concerning things in the world for the week. Then I jump into some tunes that you will enjoy. Jazz, funk, blues, and more. So come and hang out with me, the Music Emporium. Tuesday night, 7 to 9, right here on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Chatskill. Saturday, the Institute for Natural History Arts is hosting field days at its Catskill Biological Field Station in Andes, offering participants a behind-the-scenes look at the techniques used by scientists and artists on historic museum expeditions. The day includes demonstrations and everything from field research and specimen collection to botanical art, diorama design, and taxidermy. George Dante is the founder and president of the Institute for Natural History Arts, and he joins us now with more. Mr. Dante, welcome.
Thank you, Tim. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So for folks who are not familiar with the Institute for Natural History Arts, tell us a little bit more about your mission. And for field days, what are you hoping participants experience?
Sure. So I started the Institute for Natural History Arts out of necessity. Have you ever gone into a museum and looked at dioramas like we all have from when we were children and we love them and they're incredible works of art? Do you ever wonder how they were built,
yes,
how they got there,
yes,
and who created these, right?
Right.
So I spent my life working in natural history museums as a contractor and building new ones and restoring old ones. And I realized that more and more there was a disconnect between the public and even museum professionals and to the people who built these exhibits, realizing by working on them that they were these incredible works of art that were this marriage of art and science. That a diorama, for example, good dioramas, especially like the ones at the American Museum of Natural History in New York, were an actual time and place. And most people don't realize that. So they would find a location, scout out the perfect spot, and then send a team of artists and scientists to that location to basically recreate it. So you'd have the background painter going out there, painting the landscape. And you got to realize this was so scientific that he would have to paint the landscape at the same time every day to make sure the light was the same. Then you'd have foreground artists collecting plants, collecting soil, collecting rocks, making molds and casts of this. The taxidermist would be there preparing specimens, ornithologists, mammalogists, all herpetologists, all there collecting specimens for research and for exhibit. A lot of these expeditions were kind of multifaceted. So knowing that, I'm like, man, this is just incredible. And I said, the public needs to know more about this. So when I usually take people to the museum and start telling them this, they're blown away. When we stand in front of a diorama and I tell them, you know, every leaf is handmade. Mm. And not only is it handmade, these are paper and beeswax. And people are like, oh, really? Seriously? And they look at them in a whole different light. And that is our mission, is really to promote the relevance of dioramas. They really never go out of fashion, because as they age, they also become these records of these locations. They become like a time capsule. So you could look at some dioramas and actually trace back that location and see how they've changed over time. You know, whether they've been affected by human encroachment or climate change, you could use these for research today as records of these locations. The ecosystems change, the wildlife has changed, and really they become quite valuable.
I was going to say, mm-hmm. your own specialty is taxidermy. How much of that work is actually science? How much of it is art? And what does it take to transform these field-collected specimens into a museum-quality exhibit?
Well, the taxidermy we do for museums is very scientific, because we need to still have the fine skills of an artist, where we can sculpt and know animal anatomy and create these forms, because taxidermy is just animal sculpture. It's a tan skin fit over a sculpture of the animal's anatomy. That's where the art comes in. The science comes in, where we need to know the behavior of that animal. How does it walk? What does it look like? How does it behave in its surroundings? The anatomical accuracies. And with museum taxidermy, we are constantly working with curators and scientists to approve our work every step of the way, which is fascinating for me. As a kid, I was a science geek and absolutely love that I get to work with scientists and have them approve my work, knowing that we can make it as scientifically accurate as possible.
And Field Days is coming up. The event is sold out. So if someone can't make it to Field Days, what are the other opportunities that you can offer folks to learn about natural history arts and the Catskills from the Institute?
We encourage people to go to our website, which is www.naturalhistoryarts.org. And we are trying to produce a number of programs throughout the year with something a little bit for everyone, something that they can maybe get their feet wet on doing some of this stuff hands-on, or possibly just coming and watching or sitting in a lecture. We're going to be building more and more programs, and hopefully the Field Days becomes an annual event. You know, this is the first one. It was a tremendous amount of effort to get all these presenters together in one place. They're going to be working in the field, doing the work that they would be doing for natural history museums. And some of these are my mentors. Some of them have incredible history on their own with museum exhibits. And what we hope to do is give people a glimpse of what that life was like, what the work was like, what they had to go through working in the field in sometimes terrible conditions, in camps, you know, working with very little, to get these specimens and this material and this artwork back to the museum, just so we could go there and enjoy it at our leisure and really kind of take it for granted sometimes.
I love your passion. I can hear it. Hey, what is it about natural history, this combination of art, science, and exploration, that's kept you so passionate about this work?
I just fell in love with this art form. I fell in love with dioramas as a kid, like a lot of kids do. I was just transcended. So I grew up in urban New Jersey, and to go to the Museum of Natural History and look at these landscapes and these faraway places that I never imagined I'd be able to visit at some point. Never imagined we'd have travel and be able to visit these places. So being there took me to those places. Looking at these animals, standing there and just seeing these incredible landscapes, I was like, this is just the most amazing theater that I could imagine. And, you know, you'd sit there quietly and just look at the bison group or look at the elk and the white-tailed deer. And it was just absolutely beautiful to me. And as an artist, it spoke to me like, wow, man, the people that created this were so talented to create this so convincingly. And I've kept that passion. That still blows my mind. And when I learned about the history of how they did it with so little, you know, we have so many modern materials at our fingertips today. These individuals built things with plaster of Paris, burlap, paper mache, beeswax, limited means, and they did it sometimes better than what we could do today.
That is George Dante, the founder and president of the Institute for Natural History Arts. More information at naturalhistoryarts.org. George, thank you so much for being here. Good luck with Field Days. And what a fascinating area of science and art and history to have.
Well, thank you so much, Tim. I appreciate the opportunity.
Next, it's a preview of this weekend's public pickle party. This is Radio Chatskill.
This week on the Retro Cocktail Hour, we've got jazz for the urban jungle and for mid-century mad pads. Plus, we'll go to a bongo party with Les Baxter. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join me where the music's always shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour. Wednesday night at 7, here on Radio Catskill.
James Spooner grew up as a punk rocker with a mohawk, but as a mixed-race kid, he didn't always feel like he belonged. Then he found Afropunk.
There was a band called Bushmon. The band was all black. The audience was very black. For the first time, it felt like being black in the punk scene was an asset.
I'm Amory Sievertson. That's on the next On Point.
Monday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. Sullivan Public is hosting its second annual Public Pickle Party, bringing together local pickle makers, small businesses for an afternoon of food, music, and fun. There will also be pickleball, of course, food trucks, and even a pickle eating contest. We're joined now by Jesse Lazar and Austin Nash from Sullivan Public to talk about the event and what's in store. Hello.
Hi, good morning.
Hello. I love a pickle party.
Yeah, we all love a pickle party.
If folks have not heard about the pickle party yet, first of all, where have you been? And how did the idea get started? Tell us a little bit more about it.
Yeah, so I have a pretty big garden, and every year I have way too many vegetables, can't use them all, and it always felt like a chore to like pickle them all by myself, so I wanted to spread that love around, invite the community, help gardeners get rid of their stuff.
When life gives you pickles, throw a pickle party.
That's right.
Second year for the event, what have you learned in 1 year of pickle partying that you're bringing to this year's event, Jesse?
Well, I think that Austin kind of nailed it last year, but there's been some tweaking with recipes or ways to make sure that people put the right amount of pickling spices. And, you know, I think that we've learned a little bit from people's experimenting last year. But also, I mean, Sullivan Public and the community and all of it's always evolving. So, you know, we realized that what we would balance with pickles would be ice cream. So we're going to have ice cream this year. And we're just sour and sweet. And I don't know, we have some art projects that are coming through that weren't there last year, just to keep everybody's hands busy. And so, yeah, I think we're expanding and learning from last year's successes and, you know, maybe even improving a little bit.
How does this event fit into your larger mission at Sullivan Public of, you know, creating a place where folks can gather and connect and support local businesses as well as artists and community members?
Well, yeah, I mean, you just nailed it. I think that this is another one of those like really lovely communal events where people can share what they've grown or learn about how to grow things or there's an educational element. It's totally multi-generational. Like we'll have lots of old people and lots of little babies there and there'll be everybody in between because everybody loves pickles and a project. And it's a really nice excuse to have one of these third space gatherings. So end of season, celebrate the bounty, but then, you know, get to meet neighbors that you don't know or see people that you miss or bring your guests and have something fun to show them. So, yeah, it's a little bit of everything.
I saw recently that the New York Times Wirecutter column did a pickle rating, like the best pickle.
Oh.
And it caused a huge uproar because it didn't include certain mainstream brands. And so they actually redid the test.
Wow.
Austin, what is it about pickles that ignites such passion in people?
Oh, that is a good question. I think the fact that it preserves some of the bounty, like they come fast and furious in the growing season. But yeah, to be able to enjoy that year round is really nice. It's also just kind of like a savory sweet treat that I think that people just find delicious, myself included.
talk about some of the events that I mentioned a few of them at the top, but what are some other folks events that folks can participate in at the Pickle Party?
Well, every single Sunday we have a free kids art class from 10 to 11 every Sunday at Sullivan Public. So that's happening, but it'll have a little bit of a pickle theme this week. We hope that people are, you know, willing to cast the pickle net wide. We also, Jan from Lucky Fish, who's an amazing artist, is going to be making vegetable prints. So we're going to make t-shirts and tote bags by pressing vegetables into silkscreen ink. And that's going to be really fun. We have vendors coming, vintage clothing, home goods, maybe some other sweet treats like the ice cream, but maybe somebody else. We have some other tricks up our sleeve. We're going to see what materializes. But there's going to be a lot of fun stuff for everybody. So you don't even just have to be a pickle fan. You could just want to hang out with people that love pickles.
I was just going to ask each of you, what if somebody says, I don't really like pickles?
I think that they have to try Austin's pickles.
Austin, do you agree?
Yeah. You know, they're my favorite. And I think that people like them.
It was such a pleasure all winter to get to pull out these jars. I have to say, yeah, it's like, it felt so lovely at like a couple months later when the weather was cool and there was not a cucumber in sight in my garden to open up these jars and remember the day. Mm-hmm. And like the pickles were delicious. I mean, really delicious. And it wasn't just cucumbers. We pickled all kinds of vegetables. So it really felt like I was able to like have a dinner party and put out these beautiful pickled carrots that I'd made. It was really quite special. So I really encourage people to join in. And if you don't like pickles, then you just haven't done them right.
You're making pickle memories. let's give folks the details about the public pickle party. Where, when, and anything they should know in advance.
So it's this Sunday, the 30th. We're in Eldred behind the library. That's 16 Proctor Road. You can bring stuff to share from your garden and jars if you want, but we're going to have everything that you need, so you don't need to bring stuff. Austin has you way covered in all the categories. And it's, 10 to 3. I think that's everything. And more details can be found on our website. That's sullivanpublic.com.
That's Jesse Lazar and Austin Nash talking to us about the second annual Sullivan Public Pickle Party coming up this weekend. Thank you guys for being here.
Thank you so much.
That's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A reminder, if you haven't done it so already, please download the new Radio Catskill app. It's new, improved. You can listen to Radio Catskill anywhere you are. It's free to download on Android or iPhone devices. And you can go to wherever you get your apps to get it. Listen to shows, send us feedback, see the schedule. New, improved mobile app. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Support comes from Sullivan 180, building healthy communities through people, places, and policy, one degree at a time. More information at sullivan180.org and from listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
Hi, Ira Flatow here from Science Friday. We view Sci-Fry as a refreshing break from the daily bombardment of political news. You know, there's lots of important and interesting science and technology out there. Whether it's the deep, dark mysteries of the universe or your deep, dark microbiome, it's all right here. So start your weekends with thought-provoking news on Radio Catskill.
The federal government is in the midst of rounding up 1,000 wild horses in Colorado, using a helicopter to herd them off the range. Advocates call these gathers cruel, while supporters believe it's necessary to help preserve the land.
We want to see the ground healthy. We want to see it productive. We want to see it used by all animals.
That story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen to All Things Considered this afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. A little cooler for the next couple of days. Today, sunny to partly cloudy with a stray shower possible this afternoon, high 71. Cloudy tonight with a low of 54. Tomorrow, it looks like an afternoon shower or two possible. Again, high 71. A little warmer Wednesday, 76. Mostly sunny and nice. On Point is coming up next.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from The Arnold House, up on top of Chandelier. Featuring 16 guest rooms, a seasonally rotating menu at the tavern, multiple event spaces, and a brand new pool offering day passes in season. TheArnoldHouse.com. From Grizzly Bagels, small batch, handmade, New York-style bagels in Roscoe, New York. GrizzlyBagels.com. and from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville, this is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.